Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 84, Neoproterozoic Acritarchs, in which I interview Dr. Leanne Reedman of the University of California, Santa Barbara. We hope you all had a good holiday period and were able to tune in to our coverage of the Paleontological Association's meeting in London. Unfortunately, our live stream was cut short by a broken wire of all things, which was a massive disappointment. But still, we got most of the event filmed and we'll be making the recordings of these presentations available to you soon. Apologies for our interviews being a little thin on the ground recently. It's always difficult to find the time to put the work in around Christmas, and I had the added complication of starting my new job, but we'll be making some announcements of some new PaleoCast members very shortly, so expect some exciting new insights into some new paleontological areas in the future. As for New Year's resolutions, I've promised myself to get our virtual Natural History Museum project out of the door quicker by curating an exhibit every single day. It's still a huge task for me to take on, so if you're interested in volunteering, please email dave@vnhm.org. Regardless, the museum will be released in 2018, and it will be the greatest website ever made. So, to the interview. This was another request from you, our audience, so we do listen to you and try and get in touch with academics where we can. So keep those coming in, along with any other feedback you care to share with us. Do you want to see more megafauna, or can you not get enough of the early evolution of life on the planet? Would you prefer more methods? Or maybe even more women or different nationalities? Let us know. And as always, please like the show wherever you can, share it and give us a rating. It all helps. But for now, here's my interview with Dr. Leanne Reedman. Hi, Leanne. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
So as is becoming regular with our interviews, we start off by asking our interviewees how they first became involved in paleontology.
It may not be the most satisfying of answers because there's no big lightning bolt. Mm-hmm. But I was always really interested in geology and biology and actually really interested in very tiny things when I was a kid. And I had this great book called Hidden Worlds with this radiolarian on the front, super 80s. And it was all about microscopy and had pictures of tiny things like radiolarians. And then when I was about 8, my mom found out that the local junior high was throwing away microscopes. I can't imagine why they would do that, but they did. And she went and dug around and got some. And I then set up a little lab and started making thin sections of all of the plants in the yard. So I would just cut skinny little pieces of all of the leaves and the fruits and the galls. And I just spent a lot of time at the microscope when I was very young. So it just kind of led into paleontology over time, mostly by being interested in geology at the same time as being interested in biology. It just naturally happened together.
And then you got a PhD at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And what was your thesis on?
My thesis was on studies in Neoproterozoic paleontology. So I was focusing mostly on mostly on the earlier portions of the Neoproterozoic. So the Tonian and Cryogenian, these are the first two periods of the Neoproterozoic, and looking at the biology of the time. So looking at the diversity and also looking at what happened during two big glaciations called snowball earth events.
Right. And how did you get into that? Was there just the project going and you just thought, this is just right for me. I love my microscopes. I love my geology and biology. This is perfect.
I had gotten from an undergraduate, I was in geology, and the classes I liked best were the paleontology classes. This was in northern Louisiana, so we were working on much younger material. This was Eocene material, I think. It was foraminifera. So, you know, about 700 million years away from what I work on now. But I'd been reading books by Stephen Jay Gould and later by Andy Knoll, and that kind of pulled me towards the Precambrian and the questions of that time, and thinking about kind of the early eukaryotes. And I just became a lot more interested in that sort of question. It's still a pretty young field, and there's a lot of unknowns, and there's a lot of room for big discoveries. And that was attractive.
And then since then, you've done a postdoc at Harvard. Yes, was same thing?
Yes. Yes, it was some of the same ideas, and I'm actually trying to creep back into the Mesoproterozoic as well, so earlier material, and kind of reach forward into the Ediacaran, which is the end of the Neoproterozoic, and then just touching into the Cambrian. And what was also exciting about being at Harvard is I got to work with Andy Knoll. He's one of the ones whose books helped push me into the Precambrian, so it was exciting to get a chance to work with him.
So what would you be doing if you weren't actually a paleontologist?
Maybe botanist or a baker.
Oh, a baker.
I really enjoy baking. I actually did that to make kind of pocket money in high school. I sold cakes and cookies to local businesses, especially during the holidays when they would send cookie trays to each other, or I would do cakes and cookies for wedding showers. But so the idea of baking is always fun. And there's something called America's Test Kitchen, where they try out recipes and figure out the chemistry behind the recipes and how to make them better. Mm-hmm. And that's always seemed like a fun career too.
Geology, and especially paleontology, has quite a thing with baking. You often see, I know that some of the, I think it's the Geological Society or something in here in the UK has a Geo Bake Off,
where right, they do. Right, I think it's great.
Do you have any geologically or paleontologically inspired bakes that you've ever done?
And as a matter of fact, when I was in college, I created a bolide impact cake.
Oh, wow.
And I had strata, of course, mm-hmm. In the cake of different colors, and had, at the time, there were available these hollow spheres of chocolate. And I don't know that I haven't seen them around for a long time, but I found one of those and suspended it on a wire and had it hovering above the cake. And the cake was showing the moment before impact where it had, there was already a crater from the, the oncoming bolide. and I had, I think there were dinosaurs that were being thrown away from the impact. It was a very active cake.
And do you have pictures of this?
You know, there may have been pictures taken, but I don't think I've ever seen them. So it may have been lost to history.
No, it hasn't. If anyone's at the University of California, or have you ever worked with Leanne? If so, do you have pictures of her cake? Please send them in if you do.
This would have been even longer ago. This would have been when I was at Louisiana Tech University. This was a, I'd be dating myself. Maybe I shouldn't say the year, but this was in the early 2000s or late 90s.
So you've been studying these organic walled microfossils from the Neoproterozoic. So before we get into even more details about what these organisms are, can you first set the scene and tell us about the Neoproterozoic era?
Well, yes, the Neoproterozoic lasted from 1 billion years ago to about 541 million years ago. So that's, to put it into a sense of scale, that's actually nearly as long as the whole Phanerozoic. So quite a long time. It's been divided into the Tonian, the Cryogenian, and the Ediacaran periods, but only the last of those, the Ediacaran, has a lower boundary that's divided by events rather than arbitrarily picked time. And we're working on setting events for the other two. But during this time, there was a lot of single-celled organisms. We would have seen evidence of red algae and yellow-green algae, which are actually not terribly closely related by this time. And we would have also seen what we call vase-shaped microfossils. And these are thought to be testate amoebae. So it's amoebae like in Far Side cartoons, except that these guys are able to make little shells. And they're quite abundant and diverse today. And they're beautiful little creatures. And then by the end of the Neoproterozoic, there were macroscopic organisms, the Ediacara fauna, that are still pretty puzzling. We don't really know how they fit into modern biological groups, but they were globally widespread and very large. Some of them grew to more than a meter long. So, you know, it was quite a long period of time, and there seems to be a lot of change in biology over this time, as you would expect. And we're still trying to kind of work out when different groups arose and what that means biologically and physiologically.
We know that animal life appeared at the Cambrian explosion, which also signifies the start of the Phanerozoic era. But do we see any evidence for animals in the earlier Neoproterozoic era?
We do see evidence of what we think are animal, perhaps animal embryos in the Doushantuo, especially of China. And this is in the Ediacaran period towards the end of the Neoproterozoic. And then after that is when we see the Ediacara fauna, which are hard to figure out where they fit. And there's been arguments about whether or not they're even animals in the first place. But some of them have been reasonably allied with, say, the mollusks. So I think by the end of the Neoproterozoic, we're actually seeing what we would consider animals. And we actually begin to see things, reasonable trace fossils that would suggest that we're seeing mobile bilaterian animals as well.
With these different single-celled groups, the algaes and the vase-shaped amoebae, and then eventually with the Ediacarans and the animals, do we have any idea of what was causing the emergence of these groups? Is there anything like in the arrangement of the paleocontinents that we're able to point at and say that this is the emergence of this group is related to this geological event?
Well, that's a really great question. And that's one that we're really trying to sort out. And there have been a lot of things suggested about what could be behind the diversifications that we're seeing. The continents, as you mentioned, by this time, during the Neoproterozoic, we know that around 900 million years ago or so, a supercontinent called Rodinia had come together. And most of the modern land masses that we see today were nestled around a core of North America at the center. And all of this, it was more or less in the low latitudes in the tropics. And then sometime around 725 million years ago or so, things had begun to break apart and things were splitting. And everything was still more or less in the low latitudes, but there was rifting of these continental pieces pulling apart. And so you could imagine that during this rifting, you would see an increase in weathering. And especially since we're talking about the tropics, where you would expect a lot of rainfall. And so you would have weathering of that continental landmass that's tearing apart. And that would be putting a lot of nutrients into the water. And you're also seeing an increase in potential habitat space when you have that rifting and an opening up in new shallow marine environments. So all of that is a possibility. And at the same time, we're starting to see an increase in oxygen. Oxygen actually stayed quite low throughout this time, but there was enough oxygen to increase the weathering of the continents during that rifting and possibly cause major changes in the types of nutrients that are entering the water. So that's very important. Things that are going on geologically. But how that ties into what we see in the fossil record is a lot harder to tease apart. One of the things we're trying to understand is the timings of the different diversifications and how that can be correlated with those geologic events. But at this point, we don't have a great answer for that question.
So you mentioned a little bit about the atmospheric composition and the amount of oxygen. Do we know anything about the ocean chemistry or what the temperature was like at any of these times?
Well, during this time, oxygen levels in the atmosphere were still quite low, in the neighborhood of 1 to 0.1% of present atmospheric levels. And we expect that the oceanic waters also were not very well oxygenated. Only the very surface layers of the ocean could have had even the slightest bit of oxygen in them. So there could have been this layer at the very surface with some oxygen. And then underneath in the deeper waters, there would have been anoxia. And there's evidence to suggest that there are pockets of water that were anoxic and sulfidic, which is called euxenic. It's similar to what's seen in the Black Sea. And there were also pockets that were anoxic and ferruginous, so iron rich. And these two different systems can really affect what nutrients are available in the water. So that can have major implications for biology as well. We could also imagine there would be different little oases where you would have had more oxygen, say in a shallower environment. And so heterogeneity is probably the word to describe the ocean at the time. And so during this time, there are also major glaciations. We have evidence for two global glaciations where we saw glaciers growing at sea level at the equator. There's still a lot of question about what level of freeze we were talking about, whether there are big open patches in the ocean or if it was called a hard snowball where everything was completely frozen. It would have been quite cold during that time. But then the hypothesis for how things thawed out was that there would have been this increase in CO2 during the time of the freeze over because the volcanoes would have still been spewing CO2 and there wouldn't have been a sink for CO2. So it would have just been building up in the atmosphere. And at one point you would have hit a kind of greenhouse effect level that just would have caused this rapid thawing and very high temperatures. And then it went straight back into another snowball event. These two happened in rapid succession. So the temperature of the Neoproterozoic really would have been all over the place and probably quite unpleasant.
Right. So we've got all these intense glaciations going on. What was the effect that had on life at the time?
So that's a great question. And I mentioned some of the things that we'd had around, some of the organisms that were around by the time. I'd mentioned the red algae and the yellow-green algae and the V-shaped microfossils. But the largest fossil group we actually have at the time is one called acrotarchs. And I would guess that's not one that most people have heard of. It's not actually a real biological group. It's actually a fossil group that's used out of convenience, and it's defined as they're all being organic walled, so not having hard parts. They're microscopic and originally spheroidal, and they share the character of being of uncertain origins. So the name acrotarch is even derived from Greek roots meaning uncertain or confused origin. So it probably includes algae, as vegetative cells or resting bodies, maybe fungus, maybe animal egg cases. So it's really a hodgepodge. And unfortunately, we can't necessarily pick it apart to understand what biological groups are involved. But when we try to understand the diversity of the Neoproterozoic and how something like a snowball Earth event may have affected diversity, we are mostly looking at diversity of acritarchs. And so what we can say about this is that coming into the Neoproterozoic, diversity was rising slowly, and then it hit a peak sometime around 770 million years ago or so. And we start losing acritarch taxa that had been around for, you know, a half a billion years. We start seeing that these are just going away. We see extinctions. My cat has come to say hello. And what we also see, oh, now she's standing on the computer. And what we also see is that these extinctions are happening sometime between around 770 million years ago and about 750 or 740 million years ago. And then there's a big burst of diversity in the vase-shaped microfossils. They show up and diversify and are very abundant and then very quickly go away. And what's interesting there, though, is that the acritarchs are generally thought to probably be these planktonic forms or benthic forms that are just passively moving, perhaps are photosynthesizing. But if they're animal egg cases, we can't really say what they're up to. You know, they may be something more interesting. But when we see the vase-shaped microfossils, remember, these are tied to testate amoebae that are alive today. And those guys are actually predators and they're scavengers. And so we're seeing what looks like a turnover in lifestyle, where we're going from a very passive lifestyle of those acritarchs to one of a more active predatory lifestyle with the vase-shaped microfossils. And so, as I mentioned, the vase-shaped microfossils are seen, they're abundant and diverse, and then they go away very quickly. And diversity hits a low that we hadn't seen for the previous half billion years or more anyway. And all of this actually is happening before the glaciation. So we see that low in diversity some like 15 or 16 million years before the first evidence of the first of these snowball glaciations in the Neoproterozoic. So something's happening to biology. Something is causing those extinctions of the long-lived groups, but we can't necessarily just tie it to the glaciations. It's not as simple as that, apparently.
Apparently, it sounds like you've been arguing about this.
Oh, there's a bit of arguing. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's taking a lot of work to try to get at the answer.
Sure. So something that would just come straight off the top of my head was that if we have these glaciations, does that affect how all the rocks are laid down? Is it that we lose a lot of the diversity just because the rocks that would preserve the fossils aren't being laid down in as great abundance?
That's definitely one of the things that we think about on a regular basis. It does cause trouble because when you have a glaciation, one of the things that happens is erosion. And so one of the issues that we've dealt with trying to understand the diversity of the time is that we do see a low sample number in the interval of time of the glaciations. And so we have to consider that when we're looking at that drop in diversity. But what we can say is that of the, I think, 30 or so units that we've studied for paleontology that are of the cryogenian, so it's associated with these glaciations, they all show the same low level of diversity. There hasn't been a single one that shows a high diversity signal. And we will continue to to search for these. I'm continuing to sample. One of the problems I suspect is that it can be difficult to publish a paper about a low diversity assemblage. Nobody wants to see a paper about boring, ugly fossils. So I wonder if there are people who have looked at these things and after a few weeks of looking at some boring, low diversity fossils, they just shelved the project and it never got published.
It does sound pretty uninspiring to write a paper on an astonishing lack of diversity, a lack of data.
Yeah. So this was one of my first projects in my PhD. I was looking at fossils in Sturdian, so the first of those Snowball Earth glaciations, and the interglacial period in between the two. And I went into it knowing that there was a record of pretty low diversity. And I was just hoping that we would find any fossils at all, so we would be able to say that there were fossils and not just have to throw it away altogether. Because if you find nothing, you can't really say anything. But I spent a great deal of time looking at some very low diversity slides of microscopes. And you'd spend a couple of weeks on a single slide and you might get 10 really boring fossils out of that one microscope slide. And then you call that a success. So that was kind of a hard slog, that project, but it set me up for having low expectations and being excited about anything that has high diversity.
What's your cat called?
This one is Topanga.
Topanga?
Topanga. From what I understand, it's a Chumash Native American word meaning a high place. And she does like to sit up in high places and look down on all of us.
Well, welcome to the interview, Topanga. Another thing that I would think about is the taphonomy. So you say that the diversity and number of acritarchs you're getting has gone down, but the number of the amoebae has gone up. Could that just be something that is stopping the preservation of the acritarchs, either at that time or in the subsequent 770 million years since?
Well, taking first the part about the 770 million years since, you know, if there were some cause, some diagenetic cause that would be destroying fossils, we would expect that would also affect things that were older. So we wouldn't see that high diversity interval before this low diversity interval, that those fossils should have also been destroyed, but they're not. And in looking at in a taphonomic process that happened at the time, you know, this is definitely something we want to consider, but we would have to come up with a process that affects certain taxa during that interval of time, but didn't affect those same taxa before, when we do see them. And the fossils that we do find, these are low diversity assemblages, but we are finding fossils. And they're in quite good shape. And some of them are very delicate. And you would not expect that they would be especially robust to taphonomic effects. So all of these are great questions. But for right now, the most parsimonious answer is that these ornamented taxa from before are extinct by this time.
Do we know then what the actual cause of the extinctions was? Was it the glaciations?
It probably is not the glaciations, because it happened so, these extinctions happened well in advance of the glaciations. So it is likely that it's not glacially driven extinction. So what we might be looking at is a driver of the glaciation, so something that caused that glaciation, might be the same thing that caused the extinctions. Or it could be that there are, you know, it had become quite cold before we see evidence in the geologic record of glaciation. There's a number of different possibilities. It's basically what we're seeing by the fact that the extinctions are happening so far in advance, so 15 million years before the glaciations. We can just say that they could be associated, but it's not a direct effect.
So if these extinctions happened before and just at the start of the glaciation, how did life fare during the glaciation and even afterwards?
So it's actually really hard to say a lot about what was going on during the glaciations. The information we have is that diversity stayed quite low. We have some reports from the interglacial period, and there's really quite low diversity during that time. But it is kind of hard to say because we still need more data. We need more samples from that interval of time. But when we look at the time after the second, the Maranoan snowball event, there was a bit of a lag in diversity rebound, but then there seems to have been a burst of diversification. And that's where we start seeing a lot of new taxa, a lot of new species of acrotarchs with interesting and beautiful spines. And we start seeing what appears to be the animal embryos. And this is all before we see the Ediacara fauna, which are those up to meter scale, interesting and difficult to understand fossils.
If we just take a step back, could I actually ask you how you do study these acrotarchs? How do we get from rocks that are in the field to fossils that you can count in the microscope?
So mostly we use two different ways of processing. It depends on the rock. If we have collected a shale or a mudstone, that will be processed with hydrofluoric acid. So we take a small amount of the rock and put it into a beaker with hydrofluoric acid, and that will dissolve the siliciclastics and just leave the organic sludge. And after lots of washing, we would put that organic sludge on a microscope slide and study it with transmitted light microscopy and with scanning electron microscopy. If we've collected a chert, which is, it's a silica rock, and it can almost look like the fossils are frozen in glass in a way. We'll get those cut into very thin pieces, about 30 to 60 microns in thickness. So I see a human hair tends to be between 30 and 100 microns in diameter to give you a sense of scale. So these are going to be cut to the thickness of about a human hair. And we can study these with transmitted light microscope work.
Is it easy to study the shale rocks then? Can you get a lot more out of a shale than you can from a chert?
You know, it depends. You can get a lot of... Sometimes you can get a lot more fossils out of a shale because you can concentrate them with a centrifuge or with heavy liquids, though you have to be careful with that. It could tear up the fossils. But what you lose in some senses is kind of a sense of orientation in the rock. With the thin sections, you can see how the fossils are in relation, are oriented in relation to bedding. So as the rock was being laid down, as the layers of sediment were being laid down, you can understand the orientation of the fossil and how it was living, unless it was planktonic. So these are both good ways of looking at it, and it's best if we can have both modes in order to really understand a fossil. Mm-hmm. Some things are really best understood in thin section, and you can get a lot of fossils out, say, of those vase-shaped microfossils. They can be preserved as silica casts, so it's like a replica of its shell made of silica, and the rock may be silica, so you can't dissolve it out. You can only look at it through thin section. But we can also see super high abundances if you just happen to get the right rock.
And can you see the same fossils and fossil assemblages in both the chert and the siltstone, mudstone?
A lot of the time you can identify the same species. What you might be looking at is that those two rocks were deposited in two different depositional environments. So you may not see the same assemblage. You may not see the same taxa that live in both places. But it's really excellent when we can see both examples of a given taxa. It gives us a lot more information.
And when you're looking at absolute diversity, how easy is it to tell between species? You said that a lot of the time your acritarchs, well, by definition, they're just miscellaneous spherical blobs. How much diversity in shape can there actually be in there?
Well, we can understand these on the species level. We may not be able to necessarily say that a certain acritarch was an algae or a fungus or an animal, but we can understand them as their own species and how they are different from each other. And they're not, you know, just simple spheres, a lot of them. Some of them have little spikes and maybe even like bifurcating spikes, or have ornament on the surface. There's one called Calcitula sphera revelata that looks like it's made of tiny little pillows on its surface. and so there's actually, if you look close enough, some of them have quite a lot of detail, and it is not too difficult to place them into their own species. One of the things we do have to pay attention to is taphonomy that you mentioned earlier. So the way that they degrade can really cause problems in trying to understand which species we're looking at. So one of the things we try to do is put together a kind of degradational series. So we know what the species looks like when it's really well preserved. And then we try to find other specimens that are showing poorer and poorer preservation. So you can understand how it is degrading. And then when you're looking at an assemblage that maybe doesn't have the best preservation, you can still identify those fossils. And one of the things I've done when I was doing a recent paper trying to understand the species richness of the Neoproterozoic was that I was going through these previous papers and looking at the illustrations of the fossils they reported and trying to tie that to degradational series and understand how rotting might cause someone to put a species or a specimen into a different species. So you can actually end up with splitting apart into two different species, and that can affect your count and affect your diversity. If a single species is actually split into two based on how it degrades. And this causes a lot of headaches, but it's really an important part of the work.
Do you find that it can be quite subjective? For example, if one research group looks at two species and says they're all this species A, and another research group looks at these two species and says they're all species B.
Well, there's certainly the effect of different opinions, but this goes to having well-written systematic paleontology sections with clearly defined diagnostic features, and it also does come back to
part of why we have the degradational series work, so we can understand which would be new taxa and which would not be. But I think that broadly, there's not so much disagreement.
So in any given day, how much time would you put into searching for these acritarchs under a microscope?
Well, let's see. On a day where I'm doing microscopy, I might spend anywhere between an hour and 4 hours on the microscope. It can make your head start hurting, and it can give you motion sickness if you do it too long. But if to look through a single microscope slide of a strewn mount, it might take weeks of spending several hours a day to get all the way through that slide.
Wow.
Well, if you're having to scan it at 40 or 63x, it takes a while.
And given enough time, do you think you'd might be able to find fossil evidence of any more familiar organisms, like animals, their embryos, and stuff like that?
Certainly. The trick is always being able to tie it to the modern, to make that comparison robust enough that we can say with confidence that which group we're looking at. With those embryos I mentioned, yes, we do think that they're embryos, but we don't have enough information about them to be able to say embryos of what.
So to end off, could you just summarize the relationship between these glaciations and life at the time? What effect did one have on the other?
It's really still very hard to say. We can say what diversity looked like before, and that we were seeing an increase in diversity. And we can say that we also see a series of extinction events of long-lived taxa. But we also can say that that happened way before the Snowball Earth glaciations. So it's really hard to say how that affected life, except that this was a very significant event in Earth's history. This would have caused perhaps nutrient stress or light stress, habitat loss. We can imagine several different ways that the Snowball Earth events would have caused trouble, would have caused problems for life. But at this point, we can't say exactly what they would have done and how they would have affected life.
And then finally, what's next for the study of the Neoproterozoic?
Well, let's see. One of the things I've been working on is to look carefully at that increase in diversity that we see around 770 or 800 million years ago. It's at least temporally associated with a big disruption in the carbon cycle. And so one of the things I've done is to get together with a geochemist friend of mine, and we sampled some rocks from Australia across that interval of disruption in the carbon cycle. And we're going to try to tease apart how that diversity increase and carbon cycle disruption may be associated. So that's one of the things we'll be working on. I will also be working to continue that diversity study, to take it all the way through the Ediacaran to understand how the burst of acritarch diversity and then the loss of diversity is associated with the appearance of the Ediacara fauna, those macroscopic fossils.
Okay, well, make sure that you come back when you've found all of that stuff out.
Thanks, I'll do that.
Okay, thanks, Leanne.
Thank you.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone, and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.